Does corporate diversity work? Today on The Curious Task, I speak with Akshaya Kamalnath. Welcome to The Curious Task from the Institute for Liberal Studies, where we explore economics, politics, philosophy, and other ideas from a classical liberal perspective. I'm Alex Aragona, and your host, and today I'm speaking with Akshaya Kamalnath. Akshaya is an associate professor at the Australian National University. Her research and teaching areas are corporate law, corporate governance, and corporate insolvency law. She has published on areas such as diversity within corporations, corporate social responsibility, AI, and corporate governance, and equity crowdfunding regulation. Akshaya, welcome to The Curious Task.
Thanks for having me.
So Akshaya, we base each episode on a question and go wherever the conversations and answers take us. So our question today is, does corporate diversity work? And really, this is an opportunity for us to discuss in a broader sense how corporations have responded to various cultural and social pressures and so on, calls for more diversity and all that great stuff. So I want to start with a context setting question first. So can you first talk about the social pressures and cultural trends that corporations are today facing? Well, we can talk about their response in a second, but just if you could set the stage for us and tell us what's on the dashboard of a corporation today, especially in the United States, when it comes to cultural and social issues.
Yeah, thank you. That's a good way to start this conversation, I suppose, because as a law person, we usually start with thinking about what the law is on diversity. But really, there's a lot of social pressure even beyond diversity. Corporations are being pushed almost on a variety of social issues. It's not just in the United States, but probably a lot more in the US. And now this sort of pushing corporations to come out and take a stand on something, that's something we see since a long time ago. So corporations were involved in the gay rights movement. So there's these sort of social pressures, and then corporations have come out in support. Corporations have even in the past responded much more quickly than, say, the government of the day, because their reputational incentives probably push them to react faster. And now, currently, we also operate in a social media age where corporations are able to hear the calls of various stakeholders or just generally anybody on social media much quicker. And you can have these calls sort of becoming much more louder and escalated if you have a number of people tweeting or posting along the same hashtag, and then the corporations tend to respond to that even on social media. But this is on their this is what brings a lot of the social issues on their radar. And I should say diversity has become an issue that was on the radar for a few years. It's not something that's new, but it's something that has taken on new meaning. And as you can imagine, what diversity means, what types of people are considered diverse, probably keeps changing with times. And so that's something that corporations have been grappling with a lot more in recent times. And I think in the US, with the Me Too and the Black Lives Matter movements, just to give some context for these movements, because I feel like it's a large part of the corporate diversity conversation. So while the Me Too movement might have started out in Hollywood, a lot of the it spread to different sectors and corporations became involved very quickly. So we saw a lot of posts with specific corporations being named, some people within corporations being named, and then corporations reacted very quickly on social media, either apologizing or putting out a statement, or maybe firing the person who's at the eye of the storm. And almost similar things happened in the context of the Black Lives Matter movement as well. Corporations got involved. If nothing else to begin with, they were posting statements of support, and that almost brought them into the spotlight and companies that did post such statements were asked to do something more. So then we saw more commitments in the context of diversity in their workforce. Some companies gave specific numbers that they would try to achieve. So I think there's a lot of these cultural and social pressures even without any laws. So it's a good way to start as background for this discussion, I guess.
Yeah, and let's move into that, to that legal aspect then as well. So sort of as a second pillar of context setting, could you get a little into, like, so if we did talk about the social and cultural aspect, could you get into like the different sort of, I guess, sort of jurisdictional realities that some corporations are facing when it comes to how they're supposed to handle diversity? I think a lot of our listeners are probably quite familiar, perhaps, you know, with the social cultural aspect. And I think it was great that you provided sort of a more cemented context for this conversation. But I think the area of sort of, you know, corporate law, corporate governance, et cetera, beyond maybe a high level sentence here and there, I don't think many folks or many of our listeners might actually be familiar with how that actually works. So I'm curious to hear you sort of give us the overview of like what corporations have to face from a legal perspective.
Yeah, thanks. So I guess diversity is a new concept for corporations when you think of it as a legal requirement. So when you're traditionally thinking of corporate law requirements, you didn't have anything on diversity. What we had was every jurisdiction had some sort of anti-discrimination laws available. But when you talk about diversity requirements, we're moving away from that anti-discrimination paradigm where you're, those cases are hard to prove, etc. Whereas with diversity, we're not really seeking out a specific wrong. Rather, we're looking at corporations and saying, why are corporations not having a better mix of people? And legally, the focus was at the top, so the boards of corporations. And I think it started very, the conversation existed in the United States even before 2003. But I think in 2003, Norway passed an amendment to its corporations legislation saying that companies should have at least 40% women on their boards. And so almost because that was such a hard law that came out of Norway, the diversity, legal measures on diversity conversation starts to sort of use that as a focal point or a landmark point in time. And I like to use it as an extreme example of a legal measure because since then we've had other countries also get into the sort of game of getting some sort of law on diversity. And a lot of European countries did go in a similar direction as Norway, having hard quotas, if not 40%. 30%, but something substantial, and having some sort of measures, enforcement measures if this was not met, although some countries were more lax. So in Norway, it could be as serious as deregistering the company if you don't meet 40%. But as a contrast, we had in the US, the SEC had a very vaguely defined rule, and I'm not criticizing it, although it has been criticized as vague, but in a sense you could say that the rule, by being vague, allowed for a lot of room for interpretation and flexibility. So the SEC rule was just requiring companies to have a diversity policy, or rather it's more in the form of a comply and explain rule. So if you have a diversity policy, you disclose it. So it was seen as very soft, but that rule didn't really define what diversity is. So each company was allowed to define it in its own way, which I thought was interesting and something to probably I want to come back to later in terms of where I want to see this going. But because I mentioned the Norway legislation and other European countries catching on, their diversity laws specifically focused on women. So it was talking about 40% women, and some of them are framed in sort of gender neutral terms. So they'll say the underrepresented gender, but it was specifically on gender. We then had, I mentioned the US, but also other common law countries like the UK, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, have more similar disclosure-based diversity rules now coming in through sort of corporate governance comply or explain rules, where companies are required to disclose. I think it's a little more than just disclose if you have a diversity policy. Some of these countries say you should have a diversity policy and disclose what you're doing. And so the details vary a little, but broadly you can think of them as hard quota versus softer nudges, saying you, by asking companies to have a policy on diversity, you're really getting companies to think about diversity. And then slowly some countries start to push companies towards targets alongside these disclosure measures. They say that companies, or there would be statements in the background saying companies should have at least 30% women on boards. So I, as it worked in practice, you can almost think of them as quotas or aspirational quotas, as I call them, because we don't actually have that on paper, but you're still sort of giving a percentage to companies to work with. So it's, the law is still getting people to, companies to think about numbers on the board of directors. And a lot of the conversation remained on gender. A few years later, I think in the UK, the conversation started getting to race a little bit, racial diversity. I should just mention here that even prior to the Norway law, when there were conversations in the US on diversity on boards, they had actually spoken about racial diversity. So that got lost along the way when Norway's law came in, and then the racial diversity got added on to the conversation. And I think beyond the law, when we have commentary around it, although this isn't the commentary that's most highlighted, there has still been some criticism about how we're not really looking for viewpoint diversity. And I thought this is interesting because the way in which these laws, even the quota laws in Europe, were being almost sold to businesses to get businesses on board was to say that having diverse boards will bring different perspectives to the table. So really we're getting at people thinking differently, bringing different ideas and views. So it's interesting that in terms of how we frame the legal requirements, it's specifically on gender or at the most on racial diversity. We aren't quite thinking about, are we bringing different ideas? So you can think of that as one of the criticisms of the law trying to achieve anything, because it isn't always easy to say, to clearly identify which people bring different views, and it's difficult to put all that into a regulation and have everything set out for companies. So I suppose this is why I said I'll come back to why the flexible definition of diversity is something almost preferable, because companies can then use that to get different types of diversity, including viewpoint diversity.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot to unpack there. So that was great. Thank you for tracing that. So a few follow-up questions, but one clarification question first. So am I understanding correctly that right now when it comes to the actual law and legislation and so on and so forth, is it pretty much just the sort of quotas and diversity, basically statistics that many jurisdictions are hoping corporations achieve? Like, is there any other examples of other types of sort of diversity laws or enforcements that have been passed, or is it pretty much on the whole just an aim for like a diversity quotas essentially?
Yeah, so I think when I say quotas, it's asking for a specific percentage. And also, I mean to refer to a hard form of enforcement if you don't actually meet that requirement. But the other side where I said disclosure requirements, you can also think of them as, I didn't use quotas because many times there isn't a sort of enforcement mechanism if you don't meet those specific numbers. But yeah, these are the two options we have on board where it's all thinking in terms of percentages and numbers, if that's what your question was getting to.
Yeah, yes, yes. Okay. And now pushing actually a bit into something you touched on, but I would like to get your thoughts further on it. You talked about, you know, on the one hand, what's discussed is sort of this idea of viewpoint diversity. But on the other hand, what we're really talking about is, as you said, like, you know, in some cases or some jurisdictions, for example, they're talking about, you know, 40% of the board should be women, for example, or something like that. So, you know, could you sort of get a little bit more into what you mean by viewpoint diversity and also tell us if, you know, the current way that's being handled in many jurisdictions is actually an appropriate way to get to that? And if not, of course, you know, please elaborate on the way you think it should be approached.
Yeah, thank you. I should have probably used a different word. I sometimes use cognitive diversity to also refer to bringing different kinds of thinking and skills. The reason I thought I should have used a different word is because I know in the United States, viewpoint diversity gets used almost as a sort of one political ideology versus the other. Now, right. That in itself may be useful in some contexts when you're thinking of ideology. You know, maybe that's useful in some company boards, in some conversations. But I think even just more broadly, people thinking differently on different problems, even if it's not rooted in a certain political ideology. It could be people bringing different experiences, like in terms of what industry they've worked in or what countries they've worked in. So companies that are starting to have operations in a new geographical location probably want someone with expertise and cultural competence of that new country. So I think when I say viewpoint or even cognitive diversity, on one level, I think it's good to have some level of different thinking on every issue, but also it could be context specific where you specifically need different sort of ideas. And maybe you just want younger leadership. So some members of different generational groups. So there are different ways in which all of these examples I gave you can contribute to different perspectives and thinking on the board. So it's easy to just say bringing different viewpoints, viewpoint diversity or cognitive diversity. And I guess that was the hope with a lot of these laws, at least the disclosure laws, maybe even the quota laws, which are talking about gender. Maybe the one thing that they emphasize is that, okay, when you have women on directors on boards, they bring a different type of thinking than the male directors who have been on boards for a long time. Now, one reason that didn't quite work out, even when you think just about gender diversity or racial diversity, in theory, they can people of different races, genders can bring different experiences. But it didn't quite work because over a period of time, they're socialized into the same sort of corporate setup. They're working with the same people, responding to the same incentives, trying to compete in the same sort of environment. So people tend to get socialized together in a sense. So you didn't all... there's research to show that... and I probably don't have all the details of those quantitative studies, but I've seen research talking about how it's hard to show that there is actually different perspectives being brought to the table by these people. The other thing to think about is when you have different viewpoints on the table also, are people willing to actually raise these views in a board conversation? Right. If it is I think there's arguments about having a critical mass of women on the board in the context of gender diversity. And those arguments, I think, point to the fact that if you're the only woman on a board, you probably will not speak up. But if there are 30% of the board is women, then you will speak up. So there's a critical mass. But I think we can use those arguments to think about someone having a different viewpoint on the board. If everybody thinks a certain way, they're very excited and positive about a new direction or decision, one person is not quite on board, they probably self-censor, because boards, in fact, tend to be groups that are very close-knit. It's easy to self-censor in such a close-knit group that's working towards consensus building. So I think, in a sense, the law is firstly struggling to actually get results in terms of bringing diverse viewpoints onto the table. And secondly, there's really nothing by way of thinking about how to ensure that these diverse viewpoints are being voiced and taken into the conversation at all. So I would see this as almost a hard sell for business, that having diversity helps bring different viewpoints, but there isn't too much guidance or emphasis on that beyond talking about the percentage of certain categories of people you need to have on the board. And because of this, you can think of the way companies respond as well. A lot of the times when there's a new regulation, companies are just looking to comply. Many right. times it's treated as a compliance cost, unless there is enough effort made into showing companies why this is really worthwhile. I think companies are just going to use it as a box-ticking exercise. And I like to use the example of India, which is a very, it offers a stark story, because in comparison to Norway, which had a 40% quota, when the law came into India, lawmakers were looking at what happened overseas, and they tried to do something similar, but they said, we'll start small. And they said, you need to have at least one woman director. So this was, so of course, there are questions of just having one woman on the board. It sounds tokenistic, etc. But in terms of how it actually worked, at least in the initial phase, most of the women hired as a result of the law were the wives or family members of existing directors, which right. really goes to show that companies haven't quite taken this as something that would be useful for them.
Right. And actually, and you mentioned the word sort of token. I did want to bring that up today, because in one of your sort of more, in one of your articles there, I believe it was on the Conversation website, you sort of like take a bit of a stronger stance the way you wrote it. You basically said, look, like, you know, as you said, if this just becomes a box ticking exercise, at the end of the day, there's a danger, like there's dangerous forms of like tokenism that this could turn into. So I since you mentioned the word, I think it's a good time. Could you elaborate on what you mean by that, and like what the consequences could be? Because, it's one thing for something to be a box ticking exercise, but obviously you think that there's more consequences than just sort of it being a benign sort of checkmark, right?
Yeah, thank you. So I think having I started by talking about there's different pressures on companies. So you can think of things like greenwashing, etc., where companies are just trying to say, look, we're doing this, we're complying and doing the bare minimum. You can think of similar things in diversity. But there's a real cost here for the actual so-called diverse person or persons that they are hiring. So if, especially in the context where it is just one woman director or one person from a different category, that's hypothetical, because mostly companies would reach for the easy low-hanging fruit, which is, and that's what's being emphasized, gender diversity. So it would be, whether it's one woman director or 30% women as the targets are right now. We would call them tokens if they're being hired simply because they're supposed to do it as a sort of token gesture, right? It's not very meaningful in terms of they aren't being hired for what they really bring to the board, which is why I used the example of India, because that really brings this idea to light, where it's very clear that when you bring a family member onto the board, irrespective of their qualifications, the idea is that they are not going to oppose anything or create problems. I think this is what I mean by token directors on the board. And the real cost there isn't just that the company is hiring this extra person that may or may not bring value, but the cost is to that person and also to others who might be others of the same category. And unfortunately, the diversity conversation has made us look at people as parts of categories. But if we do think of one or two women as token directors on a company, and if we are other women working in that company might tend to feel undervalued as well, even when there are promotions within the company, because what do women really mean for this company if they're simply being hired as tokens? And where qualified women directors or other types of diverse members hired on boards might be made to feel as tokens, even if they aren't tokens. And this happens because of the existence of these laws. Because such laws exist and companies tend to comply as a tick-the-box measure, you can imagine in a company where that isn't the case and they hired a woman director because of certain skills she brings to the table, etc., there are still some others on the board who refuse to listen to what that person is bringing to a conversation, thinking that this is just a token hire. So I think these sort of things can really affect the person's view of their work and their contributions, and also to other people looking up to their journey within that organization.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. And actually, looking at the clock, it's about the time that we should be taking a break. So we're going to do that right now. Everyone, you're listening to Curious Task, and I'm speaking with Akshaya Kamalnath. The Curious Task is a podcast from the Institute for Liberal Studies. Feel free to send questions, feedback, guest recommendations, or anything else that's on your mind to curioustask@liberalstudies.ca. As always, a huge thanks to our supporters on Patreon, including Randy T. Simmons, Travis Smith, and John Robson. Remember to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at The Curious Task, rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening to The Curious Task, and check out the Institute for Liberal Studies. Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Curious Task. I'm speaking with Akshaya Kamalnath today. So Akshaya, I think that the first half was great. I mean, we covered a lot. There's a lot of context there. We were just talking at the end of the first half about the sort of dangers of this of tokenism and the box-ticking exercises for corporations. I want to sort of bring in another dimension to the conversation here as well. In one of your essays that I read, you talk about sort of this, I guess, sort of not trend, but sort of a mentality of corporate short-termism. And I want to bring in that terminology here today, just to say, is that what is meant by corporate short-termism? That basically they're just thinking, hey, let's solve these problems in the short run, let's comply with regulations and move on? Or could you elaborate on what you mean by that overall corporate mentality of short-termism?
Yeah, so I used the short-termism phrase within diversity, the context of diversity, which I think is not the normal way to use it. Usually, when you talk about corporate short-termism, we're thinking about their focus on short-term profits. So they're not thinking about long-term issues beyond. So, for example, dealing with specific stakeholder concerns, employee concerns, consumer concerns, you can say that it isn't profitable in the short term, but it's still good for the company in the long term. It could even bring profits in the long term. So I think this exclusive focus on short-term profits is seen as a negative thing, but also is seen as a very shareholder-centric approach. But I used that because a similar mentality of very short-term thinking has been used in the context of diversity as well. And this is not simply to comply with the laws, because in terms of the laws, like I said, a lot of box-ticking exercises are engaged in to ensure that companies spend very little time and energy thinking about it, but they're still doing the bare minimum required and they're moving on. But at the start of this conversation, I'd spoken about social media activism and social media pressures on companies. And so that's relevant here because that's sort of what is driving companies to react and react very quickly, because you did have activism in the past. You would have activism against companies, even by not just big institutional investors, but you would see protests, marches, and you wouldn't see an immediate response. But now on social media, where you have people talking directly to companies or to a company CEO that's probably having a big social media presence, then companies feel pressured to respond, and they have responded. There's it could be to some advertisement that people find problematic and post about the company doing something that's, say, culturally inappropriate, and companies have responded. So it could be any such smaller example, but I think the bigger examples relating to the Me Too and Black Lives Matter movements are useful because companies were using it as almost, it became a double-edged sword. They could use these movements to virtue signal and right, look like they want to be supportive. At the same time, what happened was employees started to join the online discussion, and any negative information about the company has a way of leaking out eventually. And with social media, employees were able to immediately post about how companies that were making these statements weren't quite treating their employees who were diverse very well. And there were specific stories coming out around this time for which corporations felt they have to respond. So in some examples that are very obvious are where you see a kind of social media storm, and then immediately after that, there is somebody from the company who was at the eye of the storm who's fired. So it looks like that solves the problem for the moment. Everybody feels happy that there's action taken. But it doesn't seem like there is really a change of internal policy. It seems to be something that's being done just to appease the outer world. And there might be a casualty, the person who was fired in the process. But from the company's point of view, I'm not sure that they've actually achieved a lot in the longer term. So if you think beyond the short term, if there's another social media storm on a similar issue about the same company a few months from the first incident, they probably still don't have a strategy, not just a crisis management strategy, but I, in the article where I spoke about corporate short-termism, I've called for, yes, you probably do need a crisis management strategy, but also you need a more long-term strategy on how you handle employee issues, diversity issues, and within the company. And if something meets your policy statements internally, you should be confident enough to ride out a social media storm. And that confidence sort of comes with having really paid attention to your internal stakeholders, which is employees, what their concerns are. If you're confident that you are in actually addressing those concerns, sometimes, because there is a lot of misinformation on social media. So far, I've been speaking about social media almost as a, without mentioning the problems of it. I've mostly mentioned it as a external pressure, a way for society to talk to companies and call for some of these more social issues. But you're not always getting all the views in society on social media. Sometimes it right, could be a vocal minority that's pushing companies to do something. And there could be a bigger majority that form the customer base of the company. So these are things that companies should pay attention to think about more long-term strategies.
Right. And you, we sort of talked a lot there in your answer, but like, you know, like for example, you said if there's a short-term response, you know, great, on the outside, it might look to people that, okay, great, the problem was solved, but whether or not the corporate structure, culture, whatever else changes is up for discussion, maybe it doesn't happen. So there's a lot of discussion about internal corporate workings there. I also want to ask you a question about the, let's call it like external cultural consequences of the short-term thinking and approach. That is to say, earlier in our conversation, you were saying corporations might take a lot of this short-term thinking and response to diversity quota, so on and so forth, as a box-ticking exercise. Well, it seems to me, at least from some of the conversations I've seen online, a lot of the public is now catching on to the fact that a lot of corporations feel that this is a box-ticking exercise. So I'm wondering if you had any thoughts or commentary on some of the cultural and public consequences external to the corporation with some of these trends in this short-term thinking, because a lot of people, unfortunately, seem to be more skeptical about any conversation about diversity because they see that large institutions like corporations, they themselves don't truly care.
Yeah, I see that. I agree that the public is getting more skeptical. In a way, that's probably a good thing. We're not, companies are not able to just make a statement about being in support of something and get public support from that. They need to work much harder to get public support. The new generations, the buzzword in the social media conversations of new generations is authenticity. So they're looking for our companies actually being authentic when they say they believe in something. So there is skepticism, but I should also say that sometimes the skepticism is almost just skepticism for anything a corporation will say. So there's this also like an anti-corporate sentiment around. So in that way, we're almost not giving companies a chance to get things right. And the general public has a problem of information gathering. So we've had repeated cycles of companies saying they support some cause and then something coming to light where they don't. So you can see why people suspect anything being said, but at the same time, there isn't a proper way in which I, as a member of the public with no internal stake in a company, can gather all the information about that company. And this is why I focused more on information, negative information leaking out through employees, because that way there is at least some sense of what's going on really in the company. But at the same time, I guess no company gets everything right or everything wrong. So maybe just focusing on one issue or what companies are getting right or what companies are getting wrong is a better way to be than to write off any sort of corporate measures on diversity or anything else. Because as it happens, people are calling on companies to solve social issues more and more. And some have argued, I don't know how others think of this, but some have argued that maybe people are losing faith in government solving these problems, so they're calling on companies to solve these problems. So at least I'll say that companies we're looking at companies as having the ability to step in quickly and solve something before government can react. And governments have almost enjoyed this wave by making statements, joining the public in calling for companies to do more. So there is, of course, this broader sort of corporations can never get anything right sentiment. But within that, I think we need to look at what they really are doing wrong and what they are doing right. Because just like how I said, negative information leaks out. I think if you look for it, positive information also leaks out about companies. And the place to look for it, I think when you're mostly as employees, when you're looking to join a company, you might ask people you know, if they know someone working there, and you want the more informal information about that company. You also have technology filling in some of these gaps. You have Glassdoor, which initially started off as just pay transparency, where it tells you how much people are getting paid. But beyond Glassdoor, you now have both Glassdoor, but also other companies giving you sort of culture surveys. So it could be employee feedback about culture. You can anonymously write some feedback about how what you think is good about your company culture, what is not good. And in a market where there's more opportunity, people are able to look at these things, understand what sounds like a place where they would like to work, and use that information. And I think also when we talk about all the laws, whether hard or soft laws, looking for numbers and percentages, it's often not looking at retention, and looking to culture and the information that's negative, positive about a company. All of that, I think, comes into can be captured by retention metrics if we're at all looking at how much companies are able to retain their particularly diverse members of their workforce, not just on the board. Because a company that tries to tick the box and hire a certain number of people of certain categories will not be able to retain them if their work culture isn't welcoming. And all of this information probably only goes is available to people who look for it. The bigger sort of social media storms may not capture these small pieces of information. So I think thinking of what the public knows and how the public reacts is a little, it doesn't capture the full picture.
Right. And in your answer there, you touched on something quite interesting, and I'm glad you did, because it links up to a question I did want to ask you. So, because you did mention how, you know, it seems in some cases the public, and even in some cases, some levels of government are calling on corporations as the faster actors and institutions in society, that these are the people we should be calling for change from. I wanted to ask you, that is there not, though, a risk, especially in that case? Like, there may be some positives to that, but is there also not a risk that some of the, you know, gravely negative aspects of some modern political and cultural sort of trends end up getting grafted onto corporations? Like, for example, you know, there's been a lot of massively negative aspects of like identity politics in the last 5 to 10 years, for example. You know, regardless how one feels about that political discourse and how it can be productive, there have been negative aspects of that. And for as far as polarization and the extreme views some people take, and you know, I'm wondering how you feel about how a corporation can navigate being looked upon as a potential agent of social change, but somehow avoid or deal with the baggage that might come from the political arena. Like, you know, for example, if the NFL is going to have the wrong superstar do the halftime show, or people are going to, you know, burn their Nikes because Nike sponsors the wrong person, for example, things like this. You know, on the one hand, one can look at it as the public saying, hey, corporation, listen to this social trend or this concern we have. But on the other hand, one can cynically also look at it as just people grafting some political extremes onto commerce, essentially.
Yeah, that's a great question. So yes, maybe to begin with, I'll speak more generally and then get to the identity politics question. But the more general concern, I think, is people looking to companies to solve social issues. It could even just be, so now we have new technologies like with the whole AI regulation. Before any regulation came in, we said, oh, companies will address, companies should act responsibly. So then we had the big tech companies signing on to some sort of principles. So in a sense, we are letting people who are not democratically elected to make some decisions on issues that really should be something that the government should be deciding on. So I think there's a concern there that we're pushing these issues to companies. We think that by calling on companies to do things, to address things, they'll respond quickly. We'll get more quicker action, but I'm not sure it's the right actors that we need to be looking at. But on identity politics, I think it's important for companies because they have got into this diversity conversation for better or for worse. And if they can't say it's something external to the company because companies have diverse workforces. So the way in which they manage it internally is very much something they should care about. But the external aspects of it, like you said, which celebrity they would get for a certain, it could even be for a certain advertisement, even a smaller company, even if it's not the NFL. So there could be issues like how a company looks. And in this, you mentioned polarization, and there's a lot of that outside of just thinking of companies. We just live in a more polarized world, I guess. So in that context, no matter which side you take, there's probably some group that's getting offended, which is why I think it's important for companies to think about whether they want to get into these sorts of conversations in the first place, because there could be gains by signaling a certain way, but probably now companies are more alert to the fact that there could be costs as well, and they probably should think about where their customer base is if they're really making it a business decision. And some companies are now actually explicitly saying that it's not for us to get into these issues now that they've learned that there are controversies around it. So when they're thinking of how they come across externally, maybe it's a decision each company needs to make, because there's a trade-off no matter what they, what sort of way they want to hold themselves out to be in towards whichever side of the slice of the population. But I think internally, companies can't entirely say we don't care about these issues, because we see a lot of people in the workforce asking for the company to say something. So either companies maintain a very clear, these are the aspects of workforce and diversity issues we absolutely will not get into, and these are the aspects we can get into, and then stick to that no matter what sort of complaints they see, because there are probably always some sort of complaints. And this is why I mentioned the social media. You can have bubbles on social media which don't really reflect the whole conversation. And there could be a vocal minority that the company is actually responding to, but it may not make business sense to only respond to that vocal minority because they are far fewer in number than they seem. They just seem like a bigger group, because sometimes you have bots really escalating or reposting things that have been said in certain groups. And then you might have certain people who think otherwise who are just silent. And there's studies about this on college campuses, but not really about the broader public. So probably companies need to invest in, if they do get into these issues, they need to invest in proper strategic thinking about what their customer base believes before they get into these issues.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And just keeping an eye on the clock here, it looks like our time is heading to its last swing. So before I move us to the formal wrap up, I have one more sort of main question for you. We talked about a lot of things, and we touched on a few times the idea of, you know, essentially a more longer term approaches, more holistic approaches that aren't just box ticking exercises for corporations, so on and so forth when it comes to diversity. So I just wanted to ask if you could summarize, in your view, what does a long-termist sort of approach to diversity actually look like in your mind, at least as far as the highlights as what corporations could concern themselves with?
So a long-term approach at the company level, which is what I advocate for, because a regulatory body can't anticipate what the right approach is for every company. But at the company level, a long-term approach should be to think about its stakeholders. And with diversity, I think employees become the most important stakeholder in that context. So focusing on their internal culture, I mentioned earlier about retaining diverse members that they do hire, right? But thinking about what aspects of internal culture matter to that specific workforce in that company. And I think even if that company's management doesn't have all the information to make those policies, they can survey their employees. And employee surveys don't work unless employees see that companies are actually going to do something based on the survey. So otherwise, they probably won't bother answering, or they might answer very without giving enough information. So companies should really commit to this and survey their employees, have more consultations within their workforce, and come up with more long-term strategies in terms of how they intend to retain employees over a period of time. And while they're thinking about this for diverse candidates, it could actually get into a longer, broader sort of workforce retention idea, because there could be people from any category that are having certain issues in a workplace. So just focusing on how to make diverse candidates better off in a company could widen the thinking about work culture for everyone. So I think that's useful. I also think it's useful, and this is something that is probably valid for across companies, that it's useful to kind of not get too much into the categories, because the more you categorize, and what I mean is when you have mentoring programs, you might have female mentors for female younger staff or junior staff. You might have similarly, the mentors are of the same race are matched together. So this creates more and more sort of divisions, and there's less people championing each other across these kind of demographic categories. So creating less divisions in the workforce precisely by doing the opposite, having mentors of a different category. Maybe a senior female executive could be a mentor for a junior male executive. So this sort of brings issues that people are facing in different categories to light. Everyone cares about these issues together. So companies thinking about how to unite the workforce is also important while thinking about culture and retention of diversity. And this is a long-term solution, because you probably won't have the numbers to show on a quarterly or annual basis saying, oh, we've now got 30% of a certain category, because my solution doesn't really advocate for a focus on numbers. But I think the numbers will come over a longer period of time as you ensure that the culture is better, you retain and attract more diverse people.
That makes a lot of sense. And our time has pretty much run down here, so I'm going to move us to our formal wrap-up. I think the conversation so far has been a great, Akshaya. So and in each episode, I ultimately want the guests to have the last word. So let me put to you sort of what is the final formal wrap-up question, which is, what do you ultimately hope are the main takeaways for someone listening to here on whether corporate diversity works or whether it can work? In other words, if you wanted someone to leave listening to everything you've talked about here with just one or two or a few takeaways, what would the ultimate takeaway be?
Thank you. I hope there is an optimistic picture that isn't lost in the conversation, because I feel mostly we either sound very optimistic about the laws on diversity bringing change, or there's a bigger negative side to this. Like you said, the public has caught on to companies just virtue signaling and not actually getting things right. But I think there is, I might have hinted at the fact that there are companies getting some things right, even if they're not getting everything right. So maybe I'll give one example to close off. A company that's almost seen as not the paragon of good culture, SpaceX. One of those sort of reports that have people anonymously talking about what they like about the culture of the company. It scored highly on one of those reports where people said that they took a pay cut to work in that company because they felt like they could contribute meaningfully to the work in that company. So I just take this as an example to show that there's a variety of things that might draw people to a place, and there's a room in the market for companies to innovate and say that they are supportive of workforce issues and diversity in a certain way, and they can differentiate themselves for providing that sort of positive thing to the workforce. And if there's enough transparency, I think people can choose where they go. So I think that there is a sort of mechanism within the market where we can hope for good diversity practices that are not all uniform, but we find different good things in different companies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a great place to leave it. So Akshaya Kamalna, thank you very much for joining me on The Curious Task today.
Thanks, Alex. I enjoyed it.
The Curious Task is a podcast from the Institute for Liberal Studies. This episode was produced by Alex Aragona, Sabine Elchediak, and Eric Segain. Our executive producer is Matt Bufton. The music you hear on the podcast is by Lindy Vopenfjord. You should check out his other stuff online. The Curious Task exists today because of donations of time and money from those creating it and listeners like yourself. Check us out on Patreon and find out how you can support us and get access to exclusive offers. I'm Alex Aragona, and thank you very much for joining us on The Curious Task.